Part 3.
Good heavens, Miss Sakamoto. You're beautiful.
Chapter 13. Captivation. We meet in the lobby a whisker after 7 and form a post-work posse. One of those groups of hard-partying office ladies you see around central London after working hours. In our case, the partying is relatively sedate. One of us is in a wheelchair. Another can't go anywhere with black light illumination. And I'm over 40 and have been working so hard, I'm feeling my age. Luckily, there's a nice little bistro around the corner that has a duck confit to die for, a shelf of fascinating artisanal London gins, which they serve in ancient jam jars, and modern jazz background music that doesn't set my teeth on edge. So that's where we start, with the idea of working our way on from there. We eat, and we talk, and Ramona and Mary systematically steal the conversation whenever I try to steer it back towards work. To my horror, they want to talk about personal stuff. But not my personal stuff, their personal stuff. Ramona has been stuck in a very expensive hotel room since she arrived. She needs a whirlpool bath more than she needs a bed. And she's having difficulty looking for a flat to rent that is wheelchair accessible and has a suitable bathroom but doesn't cost a bazillion pounds a week. On the other hand, she's commuting from the North Sea each weekend. I just go home and head for the unthinking depths, she says, where I school. You couldn't make it up. Mary looks at her enviously.
No strings on me,
she says uptight. Ramona, of course, takes this as a challenge and enlists my assistance in crowbarring Mary open. By the third large glass of Pinot, I wish she hadn't. I've learned more than I ever wanted to about Mary's problems hanging onto long-term boyfriends, even before she contracted her unfortunate condition.
It's funny. I should have gotten my fangs into him a lot harder, except I didn't have fangs back then,
she says of her most recent ex. She chuckles unhappily at some personal joke that I don't get, then upends the last few drops from the bottle into her glass.
You don't know what you've got until it slips through your fingers.
This strikes uncomfortably close to home. So I ask them whether they're also wondering if these 3 sigma and above superpowers are on a one-way trip to K-Syndrome City, thereby giving them an excuse to glare at me and change the subject. Derailing. 3 can play at that game. We manage to hit another wine bar, but it's only just past 10 o'clock, when I realise I'm yawning so furiously, I have to excuse myself. I'm wobbling on my feet, and not just from 3 glasses of wine. The Japanese have a word for it, of course. Karoshi. Death. Through overwork. I'm tired and tipsy. So instead of grappling with bus and tube, I use an app to call a private hire cab. I pay cash, and the driver drops me at my front door, where I stagger in, go straight upstairs, and faceplant on the bed. It's my first undisturbed and dreamless night of sleep in ages. A week passes. I attend more meetings and training courses than seems humanly possible. Get politely grilled by an assistant undersecretary to the Home Office. Actually, a terrifyingly senior civil servant, but I'm properly prepared for our session this time. Get our proposed uniforms redesignated as protective clothing, which applies a whole different regulatory brush to them and totally gives me cover for banishing skin-tight lycra from the picture forever. It's a fire risk, don't you know? Then spend an inconclusive and somewhat lachrymose evening with Bob before he ships out to Belize to inspect a ruined temple in the jungle that Angleton vandalised 30 years ago for some reason. I am failing to exercise properly, eating badly, and working too hard. I can't shake the feeling that I'm underqualified for this job and I'll be found out at any time. Also, that it's not a role I'm temperamentally suited to. On the other hand, with M and R tag-teaming me, I am keeping back 3 evenings a week for myself. I continue to play my instrument, periodically misuse Dr. Armstrong's office as a confessional, and maintain level flight rather than embarking on a downward spiral. Which is about the best I can hope for, under the circumstances. Later in the week, and to everybody's surprise, 2 new analysts and a receptionist join the team. And then our first 2 actual card-carrying home office superheroes arrive. The Torch and Busy Bee. The Torch is 19 and comes from Macclesfield. He's about 190 centimetres tall, painfully skinny, but stronger than he looks, and not academically inclined. Descended from mill workers, dad's a builder, mum's a plumber, scraped a couple of GCSE passes, and left school at 16 to follow dad into the building trade. Ambition. To work his way all the way to the top, which is defined by the rarefied job description of skilled bricklayer. Which, to his credit, he was on course to become. Until 3 months ago, when he discovered that he could light cigarettes by snapping his fingers. Then bonfires. Then convert a 50-quid B&Q barbecue into a blazing molten Dali sculpture. Which is when the Macclesfield Express dubbed him The Torch and offered him a cape and a mask in return for an extremely silly front-page photo op. Prior to us inviting him down to the Big Smoke for an interview, his furthest excursion from home was via Manchester Airport for a package holiday in Marbella when he turned 18. The poor lad is utterly out of his depth and painfully naive, but he means well and seems to cotton to the idea of a higher calling in the police. As long as I assign someone to wipe his nose and ensure he has a fresh change of underwear every morning, he ought to pull through the seething mass of culture shock that is his first exposure to London. Busy Bee is going to be more of a handful, but I think I've got a grip on where she's coming from, if not where she's going. She's 26 and has a file with the Met's Forward Intelligence Unit that had me arguing back and forth with Jim for days before we agreed to see her. The file was opened in her late teens, back in the bad old days, when the Met were doing stuff we don't admit we do anymore because it's not allowed. Stuff like spying on domestic terrorists, political activists, or, in Bee's case, teenage feminists. Some throwback in Fit was terrified that she might hurl herself under the King's racehorse at the Grand National. After all, if it could happen in 1913, surely it's still a clear and present danger. Votes for women still being a notoriously controversial political hot potato in the 21st century. Consequently, her file is the police equivalent of green kryptonite, except that she hasn't actually ever been charged with, much less convicted of, anything. So let's provisionally refile her record under movie prop kryptonite and move swiftly on. It turns out that her Apis agilis comes from a long line, well, at least one generation, of New Statesman reading bolshy teacher activists of the kind the education secretary sees under every bed. Dad rose to the dizzy height of town councillor, while Mum continues to teach social sciences at a former polytechnic. Bee got involved in reproductive rights activism in her teens, went on counter demos against anti-abortion activists, and generally made a bit of a buzz. Then she headed off to university to study political science and economics as a prelude to taking over the world, and lowered her sights to taking over one student society at a time for course credits on the poli-sci side of her degree. This was before she acquired the ability to speed herself up by a factor of 10, which happened 10 weeks ago when she darted into a busy road to rescue a runaway 2-year-old from a runaway cement mixer, under the unblinking gaze of an experimental high-def traffic camera. TV news coverage ensued, followed by the usual 15 minutes of fame, condensed down in her case to a 90-second feel-good slot at the end of the hourly cycle. She can only do it as long as she can hold her breath. She can't absorb oxygen, or discharge carbon dioxide from the linings of her lungs while in superspeed mode. But what she can accomplish in that time is impressive. During our skills matrix review, Ramona added, "Can administer wedgies at a rate of 5 supervillains per second." To the checklist. I was tempted to leave it in, despite the home sec's notoriously unpredictable sense of humour. And though I cut it in the end, it's not far from the forefront of my thinking about how we could deploy her. Also, she's cute. In a petite black with yellow stripes and dimples sort of way. All we need is for our next pair of candidates to clear the enhanced CRB checks, and we might even be able to start training them for deployment. One afternoon, I'm in a meeting with Jim and the analysts, now augmented by Gillian and Kareem, two new transfers from the laundry, when the Met ECC phones me to pass on the unwelcome news that the elusive Professor Freudstein has struck again. Ironically, it happens while we're sitting around a table brainstorming possible approaches to the nascent mad scientist menace. Freudstein. And our signal lack of success in getting a lead on him, not to mention his stolen £40 million and rare musical score collection, is a persistent irritant. One of a growing list of problems that are on our collective to-do list, along with the likes of the mandate. We'll get around to them just as soon as the agency is fully staffed and ready to move from setup to active operations, honest. Until then, all we can really do is map out the beat we're going to have to patrol. For his part, Jim is convinced that the MSM is real. "Freudstein looks like a fairly plausible type specimen," he explains. "And that's disturbing, because the thing about criminals of a given type is that for everyone we know about, there are usually 4 more we don't. Also, we haven't managed to collar him yet, which is not a good sign." "Yes, but our prior probabilities are..." I stop dead, realizing there's stuff I can't talk about with Jim. Sam and Nick are cleared. Gillian and Kareem, coming from the laundry, are also cleared. I could talk to them about Ellis Billington and Jennifer Morgue if necessary. But while Jim is cleared for joint operations that require police liaison, I'm not inclined to be loose-lipped about other operations around him, as long as the SA isn't certain he's on the up-and-up. Even operations that are over and dead and buried. Anyway, Billington wasn't exactly a mad scientist. Mad businessman, maybe. But scientist? I'm not so sure. I clear my throat, then hesitantly finish my sentence with, "Unclear." "Not really," Gillian volunteers brightly. "We've seen several Three Sigma instances of intelligence enhancement in the past few months. For example, there's Brain Box, who aced Brain of Britain last month and maxed out on Mensa's IQ test. There may be many more low-grade examples, but they don't stick out like a sore thumb. Intelligence isn't like flight or pyrokinesis. It's something all of us have. Anyway, you don't have to be terribly intelligent to complete a PhD, Kareem grumps. "You just need to be stupidly persistent. If anything, being too smart gets in the way." "How would you proactively identify a mad scientist anyway?" asks Sam, dragging the round table back on topic before Kareem starts fulminating about the state of his student loans. Jim responds, "Let's see. Traditional mad scientists aren't team players, are they? And science is very much a team sport this century. You could probably go some way towards narrowing the field by looking for sudden resignations from research groups or by hunting for researchers who've suddenly stopped publishing." He makes it sound so easy. "Unfortunately, the lead time on publishing a peer-reviewed paper is months to years. So there's a lot of lag in the system." He continues to undermine his own case. "And researchers quit for any number of reasons. They have babies, or they take a highly paid job offer from a bank, or they just get bored and take up martial arts. That happened to one really famous mathematician. These days, she's the world's 3rd-ranking female cage fighter."
cage-fighting mathematicians, violin-playing philosophers. Now that I think about it, there's probably room in our unit for an epistemologist to work on theory of supervillains. I wonder idly if I could convince someone else to take over as director, so I can step down and colonize that niche, then shake myself. We're not here to discuss ex-scientists, we're here to figure out how to proactively identify mad ones with 4 or 5 Sigma superpowers, I remind him. Although it does seem to be a rather difficult project. Karim speaks up again.
Rather than looking for signs of emergence, maybe we could look at their goals instead,
he asks diffidently.
Has Freudstein said what he wants?
No, says Jim. He frowns, looking as worried as I feel.
And if he did, could we trust him to tell the truth about his motivations? Mad scientists aren't really a problem unless they're also brilliant. That's part of the problem space. Dumb mad scientists would be a bit pathetic. I think we can ignore them. Ditto the lazy variety. So, we're looking for hyper-intelligent, energetic mad scientists. And the brilliant ones are going to tell us whatever they think is most likely to cause us to do whatever they want us to do, rather than gloating about their real motivations.
Like what? I ask. What would a mad scientist conceivably want us to do? The question hangs in the air, like an unexploded grenade. Jim, so highly articulate most of the time, is actually unable to frame a reply. After a moment, he explains.
Freudstein has very efficiently raised hell while concealing his motivations, so I'd have to say, insufficient data.
So, we need to focus on gathering data. I smile at him to diffuse the implied criticism and continue. It seems to me that mad science can't come cheap. They would obviously need a research centre or lab of their own, and the money to pay for equipment and materials and electricity. Also, minions to do the legwork, install equipment, run experiments, keep records, do statistical analysis. And we know Freudstein has minions. Unless he started by figuring out how to clone himself for the British Library robbery. So we're not looking for an Igor. We're hunting an entire team of disillusioned postdoc researchers whose parent institutions didn't renew their rolling annual employment contract and who think they're working for a respectable company doing research into whatever the mad scientist wants. The flip side is that scientific research is a bottomless money pit. You can approximate doing science to standing on the crack of doom, throwing banknotes down it by the double handful, in the hope that if you choke the volcano with enough paper, it will cough up the one ring. Unless you're doing pure mathematics or philosophy, of course, in which case it's HB pencils and ruled A4 notepads all the way down. So, where there's a mad scientist pursuing their hobby horse, even if it's something as innocuous as developing a new taxonomy of wood-boring beetles, I think we're likely to find some kind of low-input, high-output income stream, operating with questionable regard to legality. So we'd be looking for organisations that keep a low public profile, employ a fair number of high-powered staff who go about their tasks in secret, and which are headed by people who picked up a PhD or two by accident before they heard their true calling. Finally, they'd have an incredibly opaque income stream. Identifying such organisations is really a job for the National Crime Agency, who can distinguish a mad scientist menace from a regular organised crime ring by profiling the folks at the top. Of course, this breaks down if, by a huge coincidence, our mad scientist is the heir to the Duchy of Cornwall or the alter ego of the Duke of Westminster, in which case we're looking for a demented lord spending money like water. But that's a low probability, I believe. I look at Jim. What do you think? Jim looks slightly taken aback.
Are you sure you're not a mad scientist yourself? He asks. You've certainly got a grip on the psychological profile and your ability to monologue. That's when my phone rings. O'Brien speaking.
It's our new receptionist, Lizzie.
Dr. O'Brien, I've got a call for you from the Emergency Control Centre at New Scotland Yard. Inspector Cooper on the line.
Thanks. Put them through. Hello?
Inspector?
I'm Dr. O'Brien. You asked for me?
Yes. You're flagged on our alert list to be advised of any developments involving alias Professor Freudstein?
I am, yes. I sit up straight. Across the table, I see everyone staring at me. We have just received a communication from Freudstein, or someone claiming to be them. The call originated with a previously inactive prepaid phone bought in cash from a major supermarket chain 6 months ago, somewhere in Edgware. We're trying to locate the phone and its carrier now, but it looked like the call was planned to minimise traceability. The caller said they were speaking on behalf of Professor Freudstein, specified that you, that is, Dr. Dominique O'Brien, Transhuman Police Coordination Force, were to be notified. And he gave a code word, previously associated with the perpetrators of a previously unattributed incident 3 days ago.
What was the previous? I ask.
I'm sorry. I'm not at liberty to tell you. You need to take it up through channels. Superintendent Drummond at CNC Sellafield can brief you. The code word Freudstein said to associate with your name is Infinity Concerto. Whatever that means.
I end the call, hyperventilating. Freudstein coming to the attention of the Civil Nuclear Constabulary can't be good. Jim gets there first.
I heard Freudstein?
Sellafield, I say bleakly.
Freudstein did something there 3 days ago. He's just claimed responsibility and given us a code word. And he's hanging it on my neck.
Sellafield?
That's Karim. He sounds shocked. I look at Jim. We need to get in touch with the Superintendent Drummond. Find out what the hell is going on and why Freudstein wants to talk. Because they never hand you a code word, unless they want to talk, from a position of strength. Can you follow this up for me?
Yes.
Jim stands up.
I'll go make some calls. Looks like Freudstein's decided to give us some actual insights into the mad scientist menace. Let's just hope they're not misleading and deadly.
6 o'clock rolls around, and I'm still in the office. One ear tuned to the radio. Late summer is the prom season, the mammoth sequence of standing room only concerts that are to classical music in London, as Wimbledon is to tennis. So there's a new concert broadcast from the Albert Hall just about every night. I'm using it to try to distract myself from worrying about that call while I update my weekly situation report to the SA. There's a knock at my office door.
Come in,
I say without looking up.
Hello, Dominique. Do you have a few minutes?
It's Jim.
Sure.
I smile tiredly. I was just about ready to wrap up.
Did you get anywhere?
Yes. He looks around my office.
Yes, I did.
He sounds frustrated.
It's Freudstein's work, although they didn't know it at the time, 3 days ago.
He shakes his head, face unreadable. What did Freudstein do?
Tampered with the national plutonium stockpile.
He... what?
He didn't steal anything. He just wanted to send us a message. A very scary one, in my opinion, but a nuanced one. Pretty much what you'd expect from a mad scientist with a genius-level IQ who wanted to rattle our cage. It might have been better in some ways if he had stolen something, frankly. At least we'd have a clear-cut idea of what was going on. The implications are still sinking in, which is why they're keeping a tight lid on it. DA notices on the news media. Massive security panic. Circular firing squad, the whole nine yards. He didn't steal anything.
I stop.
Oh, you said tampering. What kind of tampering?
They're not entirely certain yet.
It's going to take a full audit of the contents of SPRS, the Sellafield Product and Residue Store, to rule out the possibility that the obvious tampering was a decoy to divert attention from some other nefarious activity. I mean, we know he messed up a bunch of archives at the BL to conceal the theft of manuscripts, but this is worse. Someone who is now tentatively identified as Freudstein or his accomplices broke into SPRS, got into part of the secure plutonium store, and left behind additional storage flasks containing approximately 12 kilograms of mixed isotope metallic instant sunshine. Just in case nobody noticed, they painted them lime green and sprayed CND symbols and smiley faces on top. He sighs heavily. Needless to say, they had to get past razor wire fences, cameras, dog patrols, an electric fence, more cameras, and into a heavily reinforced concrete building patrolled by trigger-happy officers of the Civil Nuclear Constabulary, armed with fully automatic weapons and an army surface-to-air missile battery on top. Because when they finish building the annex, it's going to contain nearly 100 tons of plutonium. 12 kilos is enough to build 2 basic atom bombs. Heads are going to roll. I'll see. I hit save and shove my keyboard away. The weekly sit-rep suddenly seems trivial. That's what he broke into. The secure plutonium store? Just to send us a card saying, "Hi, I baked you an atom bomb, but I yeeted it." Butterflies take flight in my stomach. Jesus. The first step is to make sure nothing else is missing. Freudstein could have played a shell game on us after all, swapped storage flasks around. The second step is, I'm told you can usually identify the production source for these isotopes by looking at their relative abundance. There are several other nations who might take a keen interest in checking their deposits for unauthorized overdrafts. But to do that means confessing your sins to the IAEA, who leak like a garden sprinkler, and who will go totally apeshit if they think someone got at the UK stockpile. I mean, we'll never hear the end of it. Questions in the UN Security Council, ambassadors being called in, that kind of thing. As soon as it hits the press, and it's too big to hush up, it's going to go nuclear, if you'll pardon the expression. And then, there's the question of how Freudstein did it in the first place. On which subject, they're going to want our input. Jim sounds gloomy. But we've barely got anything on him. I feel like tearing my hair out. Yes, I told them that. But we're the Home Office supervillain experts. They're not happy. I reckon we can expect to be carpeted by her upstairs no later than Monday. Sooner, if it goes back to Cobra. They were briefed on the original break-in, but the Freudstein angle is new. Whip-dee-doo. Do we have a report on how he, no, they, got through the security perimeter? That's going to be classified, but we can probably get hold of it if you really need it. But, why did you say they? Oh, come on. The profiling exercise we've been doing? If there is a real mad scientist menace, then it's probably more accurate to call it a mad science corporate menace. You don't brew up pocket death rays in your basement all in your lonesome. What about the laundry's extra-dimensional summoning devices? Jim leans forward. I heard some of your devices are ultra-portable, compact, programmable. We're talking laptop-sized, not particle accelerators. Maybe. Maybe, but that stuff's dangerous. One misplaced semicolon in your program and an extra-dimensional amoeba shows up inside your brain and cores you from the inside out. Our researchers practice pair programming for a reason. There's more chance of one of them spotting a lethal bug before they find it the hard way. I shudder. Leave that stuff to Bob. Our own equipment and materials are heavily classified and protected by our usual security gesh. Oath, that is. Or maybe curse of obedience. It provides slightly more security than your regular oath to Queen and Country. Meanwhile, if you try to develop a non-deterministic invocation geometry engine from scratch, you run the risk of getting overconfident and finding out the hard way that there's a memory leak. That's why progress in the occult sciences was so slow until we developed digital computers and had a war-footing organisation working on it. But the thought has a certain nagging consistency. What if Freudstein is an insider, with some level of access to our standard code libraries and some theoretical background? A lone, highly intelligent mad scientist could play catch-up surprisingly fast. Build a white room clone of our core tools, working at home in their own time. Worse, what if Freudstein is a front for an entire insider team? A government department that's gone rogue? I can't see why such a group would want all the unwelcome publicity Freudstein is drawing down. But just because I can't see it, doesn't mean there's no fire concealed behind all the smoke and tabloid headlines. I don't want to share this last insight with Jim, but it's definitely something to suggest to Internal Affairs via Dr. Armstrong.
It's getting late, says Jim. I was thinking about looking for something to eat. Do you have any plans for dinner?
No, I just need to finish this report and I'm done.
Let me rephrase. Are you hungry? If so, would you like to accompany me to a restaurant?
I blink. This is one of my 3 nights off, and I've completely forgotten to make any plans.
I can do dinner, but I need to finish this report first.
Give me 10 minutes.
Happy to. Lobby in 15?
He rises smoothly to his feet and looks at me expectantly.
That'll be great, I tell him, and I mean it.
Then I go back into deep focus. I've got a weekly situation report to file after all, and I can slip my theories about Freudstein in with the rest of it. I make my way down to the lobby around 6:30 and find Jim cooling his heels there. His face lights up when he sees me.
Mind if I drive?
He asks.
It'll save me coming back here afterwards.
Happily. I follow him down to the basement garage, past Ramona's lurking vehicle of the uncanny, maintaining its white van disguise for the time being, to a silver BMW Z4 Roadster. It's parked, with its soft top folded away.
Nice motor. Yours?
Mine, he confirms as he zaps it awake with his key fob. I have to do a lot of driving. I slide my violin into the narrow gap between the passenger seat, then climb in. I find it a snug fit. Jim wears his car like a glove. He glances over his shoulder and gooses it to life, backs out of his slot, then screeches up the exit ramp before giving way to pedestrians who are crossing the entrance. Clearly he's no Steve McQueen. The sky is grey and threatens us with rain, but he drives with the roof down. I hunch behind the windscreen, very glad I tied my hair back. He drives aggressively. Everyone in London drives aggressively, but attentively, sticking to speed limits and paying a lot of attention to his mirrors.
Cyclists, he explains, while stopped at a traffic signal. They're the biggest hazard right now, especially at dusk. Most drivers are blind to them, especially if they're running without lights. But if you don't spot one coming up in your blind spot...
I get it, I say. Bob and I don't own a car, although we both have driving licenses.
We didn't discuss where we were going?
He gives me a sidelong grin. Then the lights change, and his eyes go back to their hazard perception scan as he flings the sports car around a road pillow and a chicane and nails the needle to the speed limit, which is only 30, but it feels a lot faster with wind in your hair and bugs in your teeth.
Trust me? He asks.
Okay. It is an early autumn evening in London, and for an instant, I'm back in my early 20s again. A time when I was in love with a strong, witty man who had a sports car and wanted to impress me.
That was a more innocently dangerous time 2 decades ago. It was a time of naive pleasure, when all life's possibilities seemed open to me, before we married and subsequently divorced. I'm older now. But Jim is not only strong and witty, but a whole lot wiser than David ever was, and I suspect more dangerous in a fight. For all that, David did military service in Israel. So the flash of déjà vu is not unwelcome. But I'm older now, and I recognise certain warning signs, starting with the pocket rocket whose passenger seat I'm now strapped into. So Jim, I take it you're not paying your kids' university fees, I prod. Nope. I wonder for a moment if he's being terse because he's looking for a narrow turn-off from Victoria Embankment, or because I struck an exposed nerve. But then he explains. Sally lives with Liz, and Liz out-earns me. She's a QC. She got the house. I got what she calls the midlife penis extension. He pats the steering wheel affectionately. That was 3 years ago. Time flies. Then, his head swivels rapidly, as he stops and reverses rapidly, into a snug parking space. I'll worry about the university tuition when Sally gets a place. She's 16. So my guess was right. Was it the job? I ask. Which one? We both took our chances in a relationship-eating profession. He looks morose for a moment. Then his expression clears. Come on. I need to put the hood up before we go eat. It'd be a shame if it rained. The restaurant turns out to be a trattoria near Covent Garden Market, a short walk from our parking space. Jim holds the door open for me, a slightly old-fashioned gesture I wasn't expecting. Reservation for two. Name of Grey? He tells the maitre d', and insists I go first as that worthy leads us to a table with a commanding view of the London Transport Museum. We're not far from the Strand, and the presence of the concrete-blocked Aldwych tube station nags at my attention like a loose tooth. If you want wine, be my guest, he offers. I'm strictly on the wagon when I'm driving. And I've got a meeting tomorrow at 9 o'clock, I say, trying not to wince at the thought. Maybe some other time. I pick up the menu. Do you have any suggestions? Do you come here often? I'm told it's all good. You can't go wrong. He studies his menu for a bit. But I think I'll keep it simple. The bruschetta, followed by the lasagna. I roll the mental dice. Decide to try the mozzarella and tomato salad, then the spaghetti alio e olio. I wish I could keep my life as simple as this menu. A waiter turns up to take our order. After he's gone, Jim starts up the conversation again with a leading question. I can't help noticing you spend an inordinate number of hours in the office. I can imagine him continuing, and one of your colleagues mentioned a tense domestic situation. Because offices leak. I wrinkle my nose. My husband and I both work for the laundry. No children. Not that it matters. Yes, things have been tense lately. He's, living elsewhere at the moment. Trial separation? The words somehow make it sound more final than it is. I'm sorry. His pro forma apology closes off that line of conversation before I can succumb to the temptation to use him as a shoulder to unload on. Highly unprofessional, I know. All I can say is, I hope it gets better for you. To tell the truth, I'm too busy to notice right now. Bob's bouncing all over the map. I've managed to cut back to working only 70 hours a week, and I don't have time to deal right now. I've been walking the all work and no play treadmill for a while. I really ought to get out more. You're here, aren't you? It's a start. Yes, but I haven't been to a concert or a theatre or the opera for months. I haven't even tried to score tickets to any of the proms. Even before the current crisis, I was withdrawing. The panic attacks I get in public places with no cover and too many people had been growing for a long time. If anything, They're a little better these days, since Agent Candid went on the shelf and Dr. O'Brien and the bureaucratic functionary came out of the closet. And some of the mythological tropes. They cut too close to the bone. The bone violin. The... How about you?
Now that you mention it.
I was spending too much time in Aberdeen and Fishguard earlier in the year. Wonderful places, but not exactly capital city-grade cultural beacons, he says dryly. When he's thinking, he goes very still, I notice. Bob gets twitchy. Just as the whole Three Sigma superpower thing blew up out of virtually nowhere, in a matter of months, which ate all my spare time, especially after I discovered I was... He looks rueful. I haven't been spending enough weekends with Sally. Liz has been nagging me to pull my weight, and I'm afraid she's right. I imagine looking after a 16-year-old must be a bit of a headache. Oh, it's mostly about building trust. She's still in the, parents uncool stage. But she's self-aware enough to know that it's just something she's going through. So I'm trying to give her enough space that she doesn't feel the need to burn bridges she might want to maintain later. The best thing you can do is provide them with a support framework, rather than a cage. Don't try to micromanage and overprotect them. Let them know they can come to you when they've got problems. And as long as they've got a reasonably level head, that's what they'll do. He pauses. And I try to keep a poker face whenever she introduces me to a boyfriend. His expression does something to me. I grin at him, then giggle, and he chuckles, and we end up laughing at each other. In my case, it's at the vision of a typical teenage male's reaction at being invited home to meet the girlfriend's parents for the first time, and discovering that Daddy is Robocop. I'm not so sure what Jim is laughing at. I try to go easy on them, he adds when the chuckles subside. We were all young once. Oh, I know some people who weren't, I say carelessly, thinking of Angleton. It brings up an incongruous sense of absence, the missing tooth outline of a vacated life. I pick up my water glass. Two absent friends. Absent friends, he echoes, with a clink of glassware and a quizzical expression. Someone close? Co-worker, I say automatically. Known him for nearly 10 years. Died a couple of months ago. Oh, that incident. I'm sorry for your loss. And he does indeed look genuinely, respectfully concerned. Food happens, and so does conversation that is amusing and intelligent, and that steers clear of the two pitfalls of work. Not safe for conversation in public. And messy personal entanglements. Not safe for conversation in private. I actually enjoy myself. So I'm a little sad to see the dessert menu and realize that my eyes are larger than my stomach. This isn't going to work, I sigh. I can't stay here forever. And anyway, I've got that 9 o'clock meeting tomorrow. Not to worry. I'll give you a ride home. Jim starts looking to catch the waiter's eye. I've been trying for a few minutes fruitlessly. The invisibility thing is particularly infuriating in restaurants. But he has the middle-aged alpha male gaze of waiter summoning down pat. And the maitre d' is over in a split second. My treat, Jim says, brandishing his plastic. Hey, not fair. You can pay next time. His smile is bland. You're making assumptions, I accuse. I hope not. He looks suitably chastened, though. While the maitre d' goes to fetch the chip and pin reader, he continues. I've been thinking. You're feeling culturally deprived, and I've got a 16-year-old barbarian to educate. How would you like to go to a concert or two with me and Sally? She needs the exposure, and we both need to get out of the office more. I'm assuming by concert,
We're not talking about the latest reunion tour by Union J, right? I was thinking more along the lines of The Marriage of Figaro myself. English National Opera are putting on a run starting this weekend, and I was looking for an excuse to go and see it.
Ah, that kind of education. I can provide the Mystery Science Theatre 3000 commentary, highlight all the rude bits, if she gets bored.
It sounds good to me.
Okay, deal. Let's keep our eyes open for fun stuff happening in town, hmm?
Deal. He nods.
A thought occurs to me. But your car?
That's all right. Sally can ride on the roof rack.
He guffaws.
Kidding. Really and truly just kidding.
I'll get Liz to agree to a car swap in return for a Sally-free evening. She kept the Volvo, but she's been making cow eyes at the Z4 ever since I bought it. She'll bite.
Works for me.
We push back our chairs and stand. I pull my jacket on and follow Jim out. We head back to his car.
Deal. Now, you'll need to give me directions if you want that lift home to go anywhere useful.
So I do that, and he drops me at my front door. I do not invite him in, and he doesn't try to kiss me because we are not dating. But at least I have something to look forward to next weekend.